Welcome, everyone, to this week's edition of the Perceptive Podcast here on Game Wisdom. I am Josh Beiser, the owner and lead writer. Join me this week, Game Wisdom site designer and artist for Smugby Games, Kenneth Ulm.
Hey there.
And our guest is the designer behind the upcoming game Spy Party, Chris Hecker.
Hi.
Hi, Chris. How is everything going with you?
It's going pretty well. I was up very late last night working on the game, but I had my bowl of cereal and I'm ready to podcast.
Yeah, I had a pretty long weekend last week when we did a 3-hour cast with apparently another Chris Gardner.
Well, that, you're less likely to forget my name than just imprinted with Chris's.
Yeah, I know like 3 or 4 Chris's now that I've started this cast. So joking that I should have just everyone on, and that would just be a really fun cast.
You could probably do a Chris podcast and fill it with game industry people.
Chris cast sounds good to me.
Totally.
There we go. So I guess to begin with, I know that you have been in the industry now for a few years. You worked on Spore, and you've also been developing Spy Party. So for people who aren't familiar, could you talk a little bit about yourself and where you got started?
Sure. I'm actually old. I'm 43. So, I mean, which I guess makes me old in the game industry. So I did work on Spore. I was on Spore for 6 years, and I was not even the longest person on the game, which is kind of incredible, given that development cycle of that game was so long. So we can talk about that in more detail if you want. And then before that, I was indie before it was actually called indie and failed to ship anything. I had a small game company throughout the 90s. I used to work at Microsoft a long time ago. So I was basically at Microsoft from 93 to 96. I went to art school actually before that. So I graduated high school in 88, which I'm sure some listeners were actually not even born yet. So I went to art school, dropped out, went to Microsoft, then quit Microsoft and started a little game company back in the days of like kind of shareware and Doom and Quake and that kind of thing. And we've kind of failed to ship anything, basically. It had four people from Microsoft in it, and we kind of failed to ship anything. And then I was working on a game about rock climbing as an indie game. Again, this is in the late 90s. Kind of before indie games were a thing like they are now. It's such a great, healthy, like, ecosystem of games and, you know, creative stuff now. But back then, it was just like, you know, every once in a while there was a shareware game that came out, or you tried to look for a publisher. Anyway, I was working on a rock climbing game and met my girlfriend, who then became my wife, and then we had a kid. And so in around 2003, we had a kid and my daughter, Clementine, and she, my wife, who had been supporting me for a while since I had been working on these games without, you know, selling them or making any money, was like, all right, it's your turn to support us. So that's when I went on Spore. So I called up Will, who I had known through the Game Developers Conference, and I was like, I need a job. And so he's like, well, I'm working on this crazy thing. And so I went over and checked it out, and I ended up doing some contracting on Spore for a little while, and then eventually went full-time. And then 6 years later, so we shipped Spore in 2008. In 2009, I got laid off. I told them I wasn't going to work on another game there because it was like kind of – Spore was an amazing experience, but it was kind of creatively painful, which I'm sure we'll get into. And then so I would have laid me off too since, you know, the way EA makes money is making games, and I told them I wasn't going to make another game. So and then I went on Spy Party full time. It had been a project from an earlier Indie Game Jam that I never got done, which I'm glad I never got it done at the Indie Game Jam because it turned into a big cool thing that I'm kind of like, you know, spending a significant chunk of my life on, and I'm glad that I didn't like, you know, finish it as a one-off jam game and just forget about it. But anyway, that brings us up to now. So that was 2009, and then, you know, I've been working on Spy Party full time since then, and it's got a few more years left in it probably, but it's an open beta now, which I think we'll talk about, and I'm super, super proud of how it's coming out. So it's got a long way to go, millions of things to do still, but I'm really happy with how it's coming out.
Yeah, I was looking at the website before the cast, and it definitely looks like a very interesting game. I like a lot of inspirations that you've had for it, and we'll definitely want to talk about that later on the cast.
Cool.
Now, I guess the first thing I want to definitely talk about is Spore, because Spore has definitely been one of like those hot topic games. We've heard a lot of people talk about how it changed so drastically from the original concept. I remember reading previews of it in like PC Gamer to what it eventually turned out to. And I think there's a piece on like Core to 3 or someone mentioned it like a week or so ago about, I think Soren Johnson was talking about sort of what happened.
Oh, right, yeah, Soren. It was like the 5th year anniversary of Spore shipping, so Soren wrote up his thoughts. And I had written up my thoughts, like, not on the game design as much as his were on game design, but, you know, on the shipping. So, yeah, that's what actually, the recent bump was, I think it was Soren's post on the 5th year since the 5th year birthday.
Yeah, so with Spore, for those of you who haven't paid attention, the original concept of the game was sort of like you create a creature from the microscopic stage all the way up to like a grand civilization, and there was a heavy bent on like the science and the biology of the game. And what happened was when we got the actual game release, it was a lot more streamlined process. A lot of the more complicated biology and I guess genetic side of the game was sort of taken back for this more simplified. I'm trying to think. It's been like a year or so since I played it. Like you can just go right ahead.
Well, I was just gonna say, like, I think there were two in Will's original like GDC announcement talk that kind of went, you know, blew up, and I don't remember when that was. Was that 2005? I guess something like that. There was like the two pillars of the game were this idea of powers of 10, which is like the zoom thing. So, you know, Charles and Ray Eames did that cool video called The Powers of 10, which started out like in, you know, a park in Chicago and zoomed all the way out to the entire galaxy, or the entire universe rather, and then all the way back in through the guy's hand who was laying down having a picnic in the park and went all the way down to the quantum level. And so it was just showing how powers of 10, you know, if you go up by 10, how, you know, each time you go up or down by 10, how much things change. And so Will wanted to make a game about that idea of scale, but then also the idea of user creation, like, you know, making things, like you said, the creatures, like the buildings, vehicles, planets, you know, everything. And so and societies too, like, you know, not just objects. So those were the two pillars. And then so the idea of the evolution was the way to tie those two things together. Is basically you're taking a civilization, everything from a single-celled animal up to a galactic civilization, right? And that theoretically at least ties together the scale powers of 10 aspect and the user generated content, as we call it, UGC aspect. The problem, I think, is not so much that in short, what happened was there was a huge amount of hype for the game because it was, you know, it was the next Will Wright game after The Sims, right? It was like, I mean, everyone was like, oh my gosh. And it was, I mean, it still is one of the most, what's the word? I'm blanking
ambitious?
On that. Ambitious, that's the word. I was going to say aggressive, but I guess, but ambitious is the word I was looking at. Yeah, it was still one of the most ambitious game designs, you know, ever. So what I think is actually what went wrong is not so much that it was too, so there was for a long time, there was a science versus cute debate is what that was, the caricature of it, right? You know, whether the cells should have eyes or, you know, whether it should be super like sciencey or whatever. And I actually think that's a little bit, people focus on that, but I think it's a little bit of a red herring. I think that either the science game or the cute game could have been interesting. The problem was not so much that it wasn't one or wasn't the other. The problem was that the game itself just was not, didn't come together. Like, the editors were magic. I mean, I still think to this day there's more magic in Spore than in most games. Like, you know, the first time you make a creature and it comes to life and things like that, it's just incredible moments. But the game itself was just incredibly disappointing. It was just very shallow. There was no depth to the game. And in fact, I think that and that informs my work on Spy Party, like, in a lot of ways, which we can talk about the relationship between those things later. There's a very clear stepping stone for me as a designer going from the experience I had on Spore to how I do things on Spy Party. But anyway, so, like, I think the main thing the game was missing, whether it was a sciencey version or the cute version or whatever, is what we call the editor consequence, which is means basically the things you make in the editor matter. And that just wasn't really the case. Like, the, you know, like, whether your arms were longer did not mean whether you starved to death or anything like that. It was basically like, what, you know, what number was the, you know, foot that you put on, and that's how fast you could run, not how long your legs were. And so there was no, we just never got it working such that what you did in the editor, like, made a clear, crisp impact on your game. And so the game itself was this very shallow thing. You know, once you got your creature out of the editor, the editors were very deep. I mean, you saw the amazing array of creatures that people would make. But once you got your creature out of the editor, it just didn't matter that you had made this amazing thing or a really terrible little thing.
Now, with that push and pull between the science versus cute, was it sort of like the game was being developed of, like, having two different minds? Like, nothing was able to really, I guess, mesh together in a sense?
Well, no, because it's kind of more deeply flawed than that, even, because there was actually, it wasn't two minds, it was like five or seven, because the way the game was, the powers of 10 thing never was very hard to make a game out of. So it turned out it was trying to be these five different games all at once, right? Like the cell level and the creature level and the tribal level and the city level and then the civilization level and then the galactic level. And so how to even knit those games together? I mean, they're all very different. And like, it was just that was where the ambition, or part of where the ambition came in. And it's kind of like, you know, the kind of truism is like, you know, innovation's great, but just innovate on like one axis at a time. Like, don't try and do everything new all the time, because it'll end up just, you know, exploding on the launch pad or whatever, which is kind of what happened. So we did a great job on the creature stuff and the editor stuff and things like that, but then games never came together. And I think that's not just the science versus cute thing, because at the end of the day, science versus cute, it obviously has some, it could have game design ramifications, but it also just is also an aesthetic thing. There's a whole bunch of aspects. You can imagine game versions. I mean, Pokemon's a good game, right? But it's cute, right? It's not, there's no lacking in games that are cute or more hardcore, you know, serious. You can find great examples on both sides. But the problem is trying to do six games, all of which were different, all of which, like, none of which were allowed to be deep and, like, really take off. I mean, there's this thing, which we can talk about with Spy Party as well, which is that, like, you kind of have to, in game design, if you want to get to a great game, in my opinion, one of the aspects of that is following, is kind of listening to the game. You know, you're working on the game, and it's kind of, sometimes it doesn't come out exactly like your expectations were for it. But if you listen to the game and it's got a promise, then, like, it can take you places, right? You know, and with Spore, because we had to, like, you know, shove these five or six games all together, like, you couldn't really, like, let one of the games be the game. Like, you couldn't, like, you know, let's say you were making, I mean, it's a pretty common thing when you're trying to do something new in the game industry that you're making one game and it turns into a different game, right? Like, so, and you need to be able to follow that. And because Spore had this rigid, like, overarching structure, you had to go from creature to tribe to civ to, you know, to city to civ, etc. There was no flexibility to even find a good game there, right? I mean, we had these editors. The editors were just amazing, but there's no way to, like, kind of listen to what they were telling us in some sense, like, to say, like, oh, okay, this is, this looks really interesting here. Let's go follow that thread and see where it takes us. Because by the time you, like, start to do that, you're like, oh, well, we're behind schedule on the tribe game, so we should, you know, keep working on that too, you know?
Yeah, so essentially you have these five different games. Instead of making what we consider one game, it had to be these five games combined. So you couldn't really, like as you were just saying, you couldn't, let's say, expand the tribe portion, create, like, this entire ecosystem of the tribes and a complex diplomatic system there, because that would take away from the next stage or the galactic level.
Yeah, exactly. And it depends on how you think about it. It's even more than five games if you include the editors, right? Because we wanted to make sure we include the editors, because we did all this amazing work on making the editors cool and, like, all the creatures you could make. So those are little games of a sort in themselves, you know. Not, they don't have challenges in that same way. You know, they're more open-ended toy box kind of things, but they're more, I guess the way to put it is they're more cognitive load on the player. Like, in other words, you've got this thing. It's another different, like, Soren mentioned this in his article. One hard thing about even if you had great games for all five of these games, which we did not, it's hard just from a user standpoint, a player standpoint, to, like, make a switch in the UI, right? Like, I mean, you go from tribe to city and, like, boom, okay, now it's click to select instead of driving the guy. You know, it's like, you know, you have to relearn the whole game.
Yeah.
And the same thing is true of the editors. Like, you know, like, we did a great job of, like, you know, making it possible to build really cool city, creatures and, you know, vehicles and stuff like that. But, like, then all of a sudden you're switching from the editor back to the game, and now you got to drive around, and now I switch back to another editor and then the game. And then there's a question of how to, like, you know, designing your own creature in the creature game is obviously, like, the main avatar. It's the main thing you're working with. But, like, in the city game, why would you care about designing buildings, right? Like, we didn't ever figure out how to make you care about that. I can imagine a bunch of games where you could, you know, it's worth trying to try and make you care about that. But when you're trying to talk at a, you know, at the level of, like, a Sim City or a Civilization, you know, in individual building aesthetics, you know, the way they look don't matter that much. And so, like, we would have needed to do a different game there, but there were all these expectations about, like, what kind of game that's got to be. It's got to feel like a little mini version of Civ. You know, we had Soren come on, and so, like, it was sad, because it was kind of fundamentally flawed at a whole bunch of different levels. And I guess fundamentally flawed is that's maybe a little too harsh, but it was there were incredible challenges at a whole bunch of different levels, but we weren't able to, like, really address any of those challenges by doing, you know, sometimes when you have a big challenge, you have to basically, like, all right, we're cutting the bottom half of this off and we're taking this other half, and, you know, you have to really be able to make deep changes, and we couldn't do that.
Yeah, and as you said with the editor, that was definitely the huge selling point. I remember when people were first talking about Spore, and they were talking about specifically the editor, just how amazing it was, and that when you have that huge bullet point, I can definitely tell it must have been difficult trying to figure out, okay, how are we going to take this and then break it down to five, not only five separate games, but five completely different experiences that at the same time are all connected to each other.
Yeah, I mean, the editor, it was interesting, I don't know if you recall, but we launched the a free version of the creature editor about, I can't remember. It was less than a year before we shipped, but it was before we shipped. It was significantly before we shipped. And we had no idea what people were going to think. I mean, we've been working on this game for 5 years at that point, and we had no idea. We thought it was cool, but people loved it. We didn't know if it was going to be cool just for, like, kind of more creative making stuff, like, you know, DeviantArt, you know, the people who are more into toys, kind of the traditional Maxis Seek kind of people, or we had no idea, but, like, it took off huge, even with hardcore people, like the Something Awful guys had this hilarious, like, hundreds of pages thread of the creatures that they made, and they were awesome. And so, like, even the hardest core gamers really took to it, because it was just so magical to make this creature and have it come alive. So I think it's clear that there could have been something there with all the stuff we had. It's just we couldn't, it's funny to say this when we spent 6 years on the game, but, like, we didn't find it. Let's put it that way. You're trying to place blame is hard, right? Like, it's a, you know, really big project, and, like, so many things can go wrong or whatever. But, like, basically, I think there could have been something there that took the awesomeness of the creature editor and made it into a game that was equally as awesome. But we didn't manage to do it, which is sad, because, man, the amount of technology and design work in that game, you know, user interface research and all that kind of stuff. We did some amazing stuff. Like, I got a SIGGRAPH paper out of it for SIGGRAPH's a big computer graphics academic conference. I wrote a paper about the animation system, like the skin paint system, all the level of detail for the planets and the buildings, and, like, how all the, like, pieces of the vehicle and building editors work. Like, there's just so much magic in that game. It's amazing. It's just a shame that the games themselves didn't, like, kind of showcase that magic very well. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, like, the free creature editor, like, it went off like gangbusters with everybody. We had no idea that the hardcore gamer people were going to like it, and they loved it. And so it seemed clear that you could have taken that and done something with it.
Yeah, as you were talking about that magic of being able to make something that creative, there's not really, even today, there aren't a lot of games that really go that route. The only two I could think of would probably be, like, Banjo and Kazooie, Nuts and Bolts, the Rareware game with the whole vehicle editor.
Yeah, exactly. There was the Banjo and Kazooie one. There was, you know, obviously Little Big Planet for levels.
Mm-hmm. And Minecraft as well.
Yeah. What were you going to say, Ken?
I was about to say, Saints Row, didn't they also release, like, a character editor before you got to play the game?
Yeah, they had, like, the initiation station or something like that.
Yeah, they did that for the third and the fourth, which is actually pretty cool. It kind of hypes you up for the game itself.
Yeah, there was that, what was that, it flopped, but it turned into free-to-play, but it was like a MMO-y kind of GTA MMO thing.
APB?
APB.
Yeah. They had a crazy, crazy editor as well for their... But those kinds of things are more like, how do I do my outfit and my look, right, of a human, mm-hmm. whereas, you know, as opposed to completely creating something almost from scratch that's, like, completely different, right? So, yeah, there's a whole... But, like, there's still... I mean, I think user-generated content and, like, you know, Forza and their car editors and things like that, there's some amazing work in that kind of thing, but they're much more structured. No one has really kind of tried to take the... Like you said, there's a very short list. Little Big Planet, Banjo, that one version of Banjo with the vehicle thing. It's just very short. And I think it's probably in part because, like, it's just no one's clear how to make it work. Like, it's hard.
Yeah.
Minecraft is amazing from that standpoint. You mentioned that. I mean, that's, like, kind of the obvious user-generated content success story recently with the world. And that's one of the nice things about Minecraft. I mean, I think Minecraft's a great game and a really interesting design and stuff. One of the nice things about it is by simplifying down, not trying to make it arbitrarily complicated, it kind of enables you to have this constraint, you know, the blocks that allow you to do tons of stuff without, I mean, this is kind of what we tried to do as well with the creatures. You know, we wanted you to be able to make Pixar level creatures, right? And so how do you do that when people aren't Pixar modelers? We did, you know, 5 years worth of research on technology and stuff to make it easy to make nice, you know, smooth skins and, you know, how to, like, have the hands and all that stuff work together. And Minecraft did a kind of similar thing with the sense of a world. Like, what's the simplest thing we can do to make an Infinite Miner before that, I guess, a little bit. But, like that finding the knee of the curve on that enables creativity without being overwhelming, like a copy of Autodesk Maya is just overwhelming. Like, most people can't do a thing, you can sit them in front of it. But finding the constraints that make it possible for people to make things without having to go to that level of complexity is just awesome. So yeah, I love Minecraft. I mean, it's a super great example of a successful use of user-generated content.
Well, I think that's, like, a core thing of creativity, setting limitations for yourself, constraints for yourself to work with.
Yeah.
Because you put someone in front of a blank canvas, their mind's going to explode because there's too many options, right?
Yeah, Chaim Gingold, who did a lot of the UI research for the editors in Spore, had a great analogy, which is if you think about, like, if you think about Maya or Photoshop, right, like, kind of two blank canvases in 3D and 2D, And you think about it, like, so imagine if in your mind's eye, like, the, you know, a space, a 2D plane, like a space of all possible art on that. Mm-hmm. And then there's a little tiny circle in there. I mean, so the kind of the amount of art you could make in Maya or Photoshop is vast, right? I mean, you can make almost mm-hmm. anything look like almost anything. But if you think about the circle of what most people could make in those tools, it's a tiny little circle in the middle of this huge space, right? Of good stuff, right? And most of the stuff you'd actually end up randomly making as a person who's not a skilled artist is going to be terrible, right? And so he had this idea of, like, trying to get those as close as possible to each other. Like, there's the stuff you can make in the tool and the stuff you're likely to be able to make if they're, you know, you want them both to be about the same size and overlapping so that almost anything you do in the Spore Creature Editor is pretty good, right? I mean, there's obviously people who are better at it and worse at it, but it's, if you have a picture in your head of what you want to do, you'd be able to do that. And so, like, that, making that, that's where all the time went in on the Spore editor's side, is just trying to make that possible. He calls it, Heim's phrase for that is magic crayons. Like, you just kind of do this thing and it just, this awesome thing comes out of it. And you're in control of it, but it's helping you a lot.
Now, in terms of setting the constraints of, like, how far you're going to let someone get into the details with Spore, what kind of decisions did, if you can remember, that you and the team made about, like, how detailed were you going to let the user basically create a creature or create a vehicle?
Right. So, yeah, I mean, I wrote up a page on my website. It's called My Liner Notes for Spore. Liner notes are back when music used to come in records. They were these things called liner notes, which were these great things to read. You know, you'd buy an album or whatever, and then you'd, like, in the slipcover inside, there'd be these notes about how the album was made and, like, you know, funny anecdotes that happened during recording and all these kinds of things. And a lot of that stuff is kind of lost or is on blogs and stuff now, but it used to kind of come with the stuff. So I made a thing of liner notes before I forgot, basically right after Spore shipped. I made a thing that I called liner notes, and it was basically all my experiences and kind of what I worked on and how it worked. And so I talked about this a little bit there, which is, like, in Maya, for example, if you're going to make a 3D creature, you have control at the what's called the vertex level, like the individual points that make up the character, mm-hmm. right? And the points with the triangles connecting the triangle, the points, and then every triangle is weighted to a bone so that it can move if the bone moves, and then you have to decide what the texture is that gets applied to every triangle, and it's just an immensely, unbelievably complicated thing for someone who's not trained to do it. There's free tools for doing this. You can totally teach yourself. It's not like it's unattainable. Like, you can go download Blender and learn how to do this. It's just months and months and months and years of work to actually be good at it, right? Mm-hmm. In Spore, back to Maya for a second, or a 3D editor like Blender, the control at the vertex level is what you need to make something look exactly what you want it to look like. If you want to make, you know, a mutant zombie President Obama, you need to be able to control every individual piece of the thing to make it look exactly like you want it to look. And whereas in Spore, that's overwhelming. That's like, you know, that's like Ken was saying, the blank canvas. Like, if you're in Photoshop and there's a big white, you know, panel there, and it's like, you know, some buttons on the side of different brushes, it's like, what are you going to do? Mm-hmm. But so what we did was highly constrained it. Like, we had the idea that you're dragging the skeleton together, and you have the parts. We call them parts, like the mouths and the eyes and the, you know, ears and the hands, all the stuff that, like, really needs a detail level to look like it is. Those came from a library. And then the actual skin of the kind of, like, body of the thing was what we gave you control over, but in a very, like, kind of organic way. Like, you drag pieces around, you inflate them, you deflate them, like, you know, you stretch it between things. And so that's where we kind of cut the level of control. You can't go down to the individual pixel or individual triangle level, but you can, you know, make a bigger, rounder shoulder by inflating that area a little bit. And so that was after tons and tons of testing about how much control we give people. That's where we ended up. I mean, we had tons of prototypes that gave more and less control and trying to, you know, get the feel right. So, for example, we had a special spine. There was the spine itself was always there, and you could expand it and, you know, make the creature big and small or have, you know, but there was no branching spines, for example. If you wanted to branch, you had to do it with limbs. And those are just constraints that we put on there to keep things simple, because once you have branches, like, there's no loops. You can't make a donut creature, right? You can make it look like it's mm-hmm. a donut creature, but it's not really connected. And so those are all just things that simplify to make it possible for new users to use.
Cool. I definitely have a bunch more questions for Spore, but I know since you have to leave in about 30 minutes, let's move on and talk a little bit about Spy Party and, I guess, the topic on crowdfunding.
Okay.
So, with Spy Party, you started this, I think you said, you formally started working on it in 2009, you said?
Yeah, I got laid off, so we shipped Spore in 2008 sometime, and I told them I wasn't going to work on another game. Like, you know, I wasn't going to go in a big on a game like that. I was going to work on technology. I'd be happy to work on technology for them, you know, as back end stuff and things like that. So, for example, I did, after Sporeship, we did Asymmetry, which is something we had to cut, which allowed you to make a creature that was like different on either side, right? It's not a mirror of itself, which was super cool. And then I started working on the Sporepedia search. Basically, there were all these, you know, there's millions and millions and millions of creatures in there and vehicles and editors and buildings and stuff, but you couldn't really find them. And so I started doing some research on how to do good search. Like, I started talking to the architects of Flickr and things like that. But at that point, like, Spore had done okay, but was not, you know, it was not a gangbuster hit, obviously. And so they needed to downsize the studio, and I was expensive and told them I was not going to work on another game, and so I got laid off. So that was, and I'm friends with all the people who are there still and everything, including the Lucy Bradshaw, who laid me off, who I'm going to lunch with tomorrow. so no hard feelings at all. But so then I was like, okay, well, I was thinking about, that was September, August, late August, early September, and I had been thinking for a while that I was going to quit in January and work on Spy Party full time. And I wonder, in the alternate universe where I didn't get laid off, I wonder if I actually quit. You know, because like, it's hard to like leave the big salary and the like, you know, cushy job, and like, it's so comfortable. And so it was kind of the boot to the ass that I needed to actually get out the door, I think. So I'm worried. I'm worried in that other universe that I still work at EA.
Definitely, with that, well, especially with what's happening with EA now.
I mean,
what were you going to say, Ken?
I'm going to say, you have, as a indie dev, you have great publicity, and you know, you have a lot closer connection to all your fans. And I think a lot of people have a lot of faith in Spy Party. Just like when you initially threw the concept out there, people were all over it. I remember all the hype for Spy Party.
Right. I mean, it really resonates with people, which is great. I mean, I think it's like, I knock on wood, because who knows, it could all go pear-shaped at this point. But like, it's been working out really well. And like, the I learned so much on Spore. Like, so for example, one of the things we did on Spore was, during Spore, there was this lecture came out by Rob Pardo, who's the chief game designer of Blizzard. He gave a lecture at the Austin GDC, and he talked about what he calls their depth first, accessibility later development methodology. And basically the way they work is, you know, you want to make a game like StarCraft, you basically make the 300-hour or 1,000-hour game loop first. You make the hardest core game you can, and then you make it accessible later. Mm-hmm. And on Spore, we kind of did accessibility first, depth never. And so I vowed, you know, because we basically were so worried about accessibility, because like, this is a Maxis game and it needs to be able to appeal to everybody, but we never got that core loop that we were talking about earlier. And so on Spy Party, I vowed I decided I'm going to do depth first, accessibility later, no matter what. So that's why the game is so hard to learn how to play right now, because I just haven't spent any time on it. But the depth is there. Like, we have, you know, the top players have over, you know, 350 hours of gameplay time in and stuff, and like, they don't feel like there's a skill ceiling yet. So I'm trying to make that kind of like competitive multiplayer game like StarCraft or Counter-Strike or, you know, League of Legends or Street Fighter, those kinds of games, but about human behavior. And so that's where that depth first, accessibility later thing comes in. Like, I'm really focusing on it, on making the core deep gameplay. And like you said, it resonates with people. Like, people hear immediately, like, okay, it's a two-player game, and one player, you know, is playing a character at a party, but everybody else at the party is controlled by the computer, and the other player's outside trying to figure out who the spy is inside the party. And like, people can instantly kind of feel what they think the game's going to be like. I mean, even if they're like a little bit off or whatever, like, it instantly, like, you know, you can kind of go, oh, I can see a game about that. Whereas on Spore, it's kind of hard, actually. Like, if you think about it, like, from a concept, Spore was a very strong concept, as we talked about from the big, you know, GDC reveal, but it was not, you don't have a picture in your mind of what the game feels like to play, whereas you do with Spy Party, right? And so I think it's a lot easier when you have a game. It's not that all games have to have that, like, really resonating, like, instant appeal kind of thing, but it certainly makes it a lot easier to, you know, follow your gut when you've got a really good picture of what the game actually feels like to play. And it got playable really early. So, like, when I got laid off, and then after that, it was only a couple months until, you could basically kind of play the game. I mean, really crappily, but you could basically play it and say, like, oh yeah, there's actually really a game here.
I think that's a really good point when you said about creating that complexity loop first and then building the game around that, as opposed to the other way around. And that's what we're seeing with a lot of indie developers. They're basically creating that core game mechanic, or the twist or the hook of the game, and then over iteration and iteration, they sort of make it more accessible. We've seen this with, I would say, I've been playing the game Kerbal Space Program on and off, and that's a game that it is immensely complex, but at the same time, it has, like, at this point, technically, has zero accessibility in the game.
Right.
It's just very hard to learn, but there are people who are in like galaxies and solar systems, and they're doing all kinds of crazy stuff, and they love it. They're spending like hundreds of hours on a game that's at version 0.22 that just came out yesterday.
Right. I mean, I think this gets into the crowdfunding thing, which you wanted to talk about, which is one of the things that makes right now the golden age of indie games, in my opinion, is this idea that, or this truth that there are so many people on the internet, and the internet is so well connected, and downloading things is so easy now, and like, you know, PayPal or Steam or all these different like ways of, you know, of getting access to these smaller games, that even if you ship a game that is basically impossible for people to play, but is really awesome if they're actually willing to, like, you know, learn how to play it, like, you can appeal to a large enough group of people to make a sustainable living doing that. And that's magic. That's kind of an amazing thing. So Spy Party, like, I will eventually make it really polished, you know, from a, excuse me, from a new user standpoint and accessible and all that stuff, but I don't need to yet. It's probably turning off people. You know, there are probably people who, like, see it at a trade show or whatever and, like, see that I have a manual you're supposed to read before you play, and they're like, ah, I'll come back to this later. And that's okay, though, because there's, you know, there's enough people who are willing to, like, you know, kind of do their homework to try and play this new and wacky, interesting idea, that it can make a sustainable living. And that's great, because then you can keep going and then eventually make the game deeper and deeper and deeper and then make it accessible. And then those other people will come back, you know, they'll try it as well. And so it's just this great thing. Like, Kerbal Space Program is a perfect example of, like, I mean, that is a hardcore game with crazy, you know, I mean, a lot of these games nowadays are pretty hardcore. I mean, Spelunky, you know, like, I mean, these permadeath, you know, roguelikes and stuff like that. It's just great. There's just enough people online and enough people interested in trying different ideas and things like that in games like that, that it makes it sustainable, which is the key, right? It's not, the goal is not to get rich. The goal is to be able to make enough money to make games, so you can keep making games. And so crowdfunding is a part of that. People want to be a part of the development of these games. Not everybody. Like, I get, you know, email every couple of days with, like, you know, I don't really like paying for betas. We should be just explicit. So Spy Party is an open paid beta, right? So it's a early access beta. It was closed beta for a year and a half, which meant that I took signups on the webpage and then sent invites, like, you know, 500 invites a week or whatever. And then finally last May, I opened it up, and now you can just go to the website, pay me $15 and be playing in assuming PayPal sends the receipt through properly, it'd be playing in 10, you know, a minute or two. So you can basically just go buy the game right now. But it's very ugly right now. I mean, there's a new level with the new art, which I think we'll talk about later. But for the most part, it's very rough. But it's a very deep and interesting game. And, like, you know, the community's great. They'll help you learn and everything like that. But it's a hard. It's very new. It's different. There's not a lot of games like it. So there's not, you know, you're not bringing, like, you know, even in a game like Braid, you brought your Super Mario skills to that game, right? So you kind of knew, I walk to the right and I can jump. Cool, I got it. Whereas in Spy Party, you're like, what is going on here? So there's a lot of training that goes even just to be able to play. But enough people are, like, into that idea of being there early and, like, seeing the game evolve. Like, the last few ideas, the last mission I put in and the last map I put in were both player suggested in the beta forums. And so it's great to involve players at that level. And so crowdfunding is a way it helps that, not only from the design standpoint of getting feedback, but also from the funding point standpoint. It's like, it allows people to be involved, people who want, you know, have an appetite for that kind of early access thing. It allows them to kind of participate in the game, and that's awesome. And I never am upset when somebody doesn't want to register as a beta. Like, I know.
And it also allows.
Yeah, go on. Say.
Oh, I was about to say, like, and all that marketing too, because I remember my first account of seeing the actual gameplay was through a Let's Play, and this guy was telling me all his techniques, and, like, oh, well, I'll try this. Well, that guy was too clever. Maybe I'll try this. And it was doing all these different kind of things and calling things out, and it was super interesting. Even though the game, you know, with it, you have the new art after, which is great, it still was really impressive in terms of how it, gameplay accented, you know, everything else.
Totally. Yeah, I mean, I think that, like it doesn't work for every kind of game. Like, the early access, so there's different kinds of crowdfunding, right? And, like, different kinds of ways of talking about your game. So, like, the kind of thing I'm doing, which is, like, let people play your game really early, works for games that are kind of, you know, competitive multiplayer games. It works for UGC, you know, user-generated content games like Minecraft. It works for games that have a lot of procedural generation like Spelunky. But, like, it wouldn't work for The Witness, right? It's a puzzle game. Like, you can't play a puzzle game and then not be spoilered, right? Yeah. So it's only compatible with a few kinds of games. The full early access. But when it does work, like Ken was just saying, it works great because, like, people see your game, like, you know, people stream the game on Twitch every day, and it allows people to get a taste for it, and that's awesome. Yeah, I mean, I'm really happy that it's worked out so well, that it got fun as early as it did, like, that, you know, the core loop got found, because, like, I mean, you can't release, people are really good at players are really good at like extrapolating what art might look like. You know, if you can show rough art, or you can show rough sound design and things like that. Mm-hmm. But rough gameplay is very hard for players to extrapolate. It's hard for designers to extrapolate too. So if the gameplay is not feeling close to what you want, it's very risky to like actually release a demo. You see this happen sometimes where people mm-hmm. like, you know, have a demo on Kickstarter that's how it works when you're doing a game. You know, the thing's not great for a long time, but if you put that demo up there for people to play, they kind of think that like the game's never going to come together if the demo's mm-hmm. too rough. It can be graphically rough, but if the gameplay is not there. So there's a bunch of things I think that make it, you know, that are important for doing this kind of early access thing, like different things to think about and whatnot. But it's great that it's a healthy way to make games now. It's super cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say another good example of having at least the basic concept on and then developing up from there would be what Introversion did with Prison Architect. And how it's at Alpha 14 right now, but when they announced the game way back, I think it's been at least a year, maybe even more, they just had this very base idea, you're going to build and manage a prison. That was it. That was the core gameplay. And then people bought into that, and they support that. And over the months, they've been adding and refining, because as you said, that core gameplay, at that time, it resonated with enough people to support them. And now they're able to expand it and basically build upon their original vision.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Like, it's just showing that it's the golden age of indie, but in that it's still the Wild West. Like, they're doing the exact opposite of Minecraft in the sense that they're charging more now and say they're going to drop the price later, whereas Minecraft charged less early and then mm-hmm. raised the price as it went on. And so it's like, no one even knows what the best way to do this even is. Like, with Spy Party, because it's a multiplayer game, like, I am probably just keeping the price at $15. Like, but I mean, you know, the new art's really expensive to make and looks really good. So I could see maybe raising it later, but like I can see arguments for doing all of these different things. Mm-hmm. It's really hard to know, but it's great that everybody's trying different things. Yeah. Introversion never even took their thing to Kickstarter. They just did it all on their own website. Yeah. And you see a few other games doing that kind of thing now too.
Mm-hmm. During a Res talk, they talked how they wanted to stay completely free of anybody. They respected Kickstarter, but they wanted to be completely independent so they can make their own choices.
Right,
The reason they had their price so high too, at least like $30, which is like one of those weird analogous prices, because you usually go like 15 or like 50, right? You don't go in the between. But they said it because they already had, they're already established and they had a good fan base that believed in them. They could charge that cost.
Well, and they also said, like, they wanted to keep out people who were just like, oh, I'll try out this game this weekend, you know, because it was broken. Mm-hmm. Like, they wanted to, like, set the price high enough that you kind of knew, it made you think, you know what you're getting into. This is like, I'm really going to, like, you know, you kind of have an investment there that's mm-hmm. you know, you're not just looking for an impulse buy. And you can see that now with Planetary Annihilation. Their beta is like $60 or something crazy like that.
It was at $80 for the alpha, like, up until, like, a month or so ago.
Yeah, it's nuts. I mean, it's just it's who knows what the right way to do that is. And there's probably not one right way to do it, and that's what's great. Like, yeah, I mean, on the Kickstarter thing, I think that I feel the same way they feel, which is I like to have control over all the variables, and mm-hmm. so, like, that's why I wrote my own entire back end and everything, which is insane. Nowadays, I would just suggest, even if you don't want to go on Steam, I would suggest to people that the Humble Store widget is just by far the best way to do this. If you're like, if you're a game developer listening to this, don't do what I did and write your entire own back end. Just use the Humble Store widget. But the nice thing about doing it all yourself is now I have total understanding of all the different pieces and how they all fit together. So if, like, for example, mm-hmm. I use Kerberos, which is a security system that's used by Xbox, by you know, Windows domain controllers and Xbox Live, and Steam uses a kind of like a in-house version of a similar kind of thing. But now I can go like, okay, I want to do spawn copies, you know, where this copy can only play, where this account has a guest account that can only play that account. And if someone says to me, oh, you can't really do that, you know, on our system that I want to put my game on, I'm like, yeah, you can. You just have to do this, this, and this. I know exactly how it works. So, yeah, so I have a pretty, I don't think it's an NIH as much as it is I like to do it myself. But there's just so many different ways. I mean, anything from putting a PayPal button up on there to using some of the older shareware kind of sites. Like, there's Klifsky from, Positech, you know, Gratuitous Space Battles in mm-hmm. the UK. He uses one of those just services that'll do, you know, credit card billing for you. There's PayPal, there's Humble Store widget, there's, you know, going, and it's all the way, you can put it on Steam. There's just so many different options. And then there's a whole bunch of smaller ones, you know, like Good Old Games and those kinds of things. So there's lots of different options now, and that's super awesome. It's just really a great time. Cause what that stuff is business stuff, which is kind of boring in the sense that, you know, the thing you need to spend most of your energy on is the game design. You want to make mm-hmm. a great game. But the business stuff is important in the sense that you need to be able to eat. You need to be able to, like, get that stuff taken care of so that you can then spend the time on the game design. So the business stuff is kind of like a base level thing that needs to be working okay. in order to kind of enable you to do the game design as well.
Yeah, definitely. And that's something that I see a lot of enthusiasts or people who aren't too familiar with the industry sort of mess up on. Like when you talk to someone who's like, oh, I don't care about selling the game. I just want to make a great game and stuff like that. I mean, it's great that you're passionate, but at the same time, if you can't support yourself with the game, then, you know, you're going to be out of the street in like a few months.
Well, I mean, there's another side of this, though, that I think is really healthy, which is people making games for free just in their spare time that they want to put up. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's awesome. There's some really good games that people just made for free. Some people have actually managed to turn it into a business as well. I think the mm-hmm. game has to come first in the sense that, like, the game is the most, like, a good game will sell and a bad game won't sell. If, whether you want to sell it for money or whether you just want to put it up on your website and get attention for it or just even just try new things. There's a learning aspect to it too, which is just like, you know, some people are just making games and putting them on their website just so they can get more familiar with how it works. Mm-hmm. It's just fun and creative, yeah. And that's cool too. So I think it's great that indie games are so broad now. There's everything from a ton of free, I mean, everything from like, you know, Twine games, Twine is this HTML browser, like kind of choose your own adventure game maker thing, which basically requires no programming knowledge at all to make. And there's some really interesting, works in that too. So basically everything from that all the way up to these giant AAA indie games, just kind of the way that Spy Party is going, you know, like really huge, complicated, technical, you know, more focused than a big AAA, console game. But huge and a big, you know, risk and investment and stuff like that. So I think it's great that indie games includes all of that because it makes for a lot more creativity.
Yeah. Now, before we move on and talk specifically about Spy Party, I have one more question for you about crowdfunding in general. And this is a question that I'd like to ask all the designers who come on. As we've seen over the last year, Kickstarter has obviously grown thanks to Double Fine, Project Eternity, and so on. But we're having the sort of debate if it isn't actually a sustainable model. If, you know, in a few years from now, we can still go on Kickstarter, put a game up, and get enough money. And I've spoken to designers over the last few weeks, and we're basically getting different responses. Some say that it will remain viable, while others aren't so sure about it. So, Chris, from your own point of view, do you see crowdfunding to stay as a sustainable model for game development?
Yeah, I mean, as the question as asked, crowdfunding completely generally, yes, totally. Mm-hmm. I think it's a great thing. To focus specifically on the Kickstarter, also the answer is yes, in the sense that I don't think it's going to be the gold rush that it was for a little while there, like where everybody mm-hmm. was crawling out of the woodwork with their, like, you know, 15-year-old game that they wanted to make a sequel to now and getting $1 million for it. That's obviously past now, if it's not already past. But I think it is sustainable if it's done in a healthy way. So I think that crowdfunding is not a fad. I think that it will continue to be a thing. I think, like, there was a gold rush period in the way that everything on the internet has a gold rush period to it. But that I think with a good pitch and asking for a reasonable amount of money and, you know, having a good video and all that stuff, I think people will continue to be able to make Kickstarter work. I actually worry a little bit about my only concern with Kickstarter really is the kind of distraction of having to do all the pitch and all the reward tiers mm-hmm. and all that stuff. Like, it's a ton of work. And the cliff funding model makes it so that you kind of are incented to lowball your price a little bit, you know, so because you're more likely to get all or nothing, you know, because you need to get all or nothing. So I've got some concerns about Kickstarter specifically that maybe they'll change over the time or I don't know. You know, there's a whole bunch of different things there. But as crowdfunding in general, I think I'm totally bullish on. I think it's a good thing. I think, you know, especially open betas and things like that for games that are compatible with it. I think it's I'm definitely, it's great to take, I mean, by far the best way to fund your game is by savings, right? Because, mm-hmm. assuming you're confident in your game, because you have total control, even with, you know, even with the open beta where I don't have to do, you know, I didn't have to do videos where I promised t-shirts and, like, you know, random figurines and stuff for mm-hmm. my game. You know, you just come pay me $15 and you get the game, but there's still, I got to fix bugs. I got to make sure it works on someone's machine. You know, if someone's having troubles with it, I've got to do technical support. There's overhead that comes with taking money, even in the yeah. simplest way possible, which I think is open betas. But it's nothing compared to publisher money, which is just terrible. It's like poisonous, basically. So I'm really glad there are so many healthy alternatives to that now.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and this next part I feel like too long getting the conversation about now, but there's definitely been that sense that AAA developers are run into a lot more trouble these days. I know when I talked with John Schaefer, we're definitely noticing a case where a lot of AAA games are becoming more simplified, less creative, and the market seems to be running this issue where unless you put out this bombastic game, if you're spending millions of dollars to create one game and it fails, you're pretty much out on the street the next day. Yeah, so it's forcing a lot of developers to basically not take risk and not to make interesting game design.
Right. I mean, if I was investing, I mean, I don't actually have $100 million, but if I was investing my $100 million into a game, I would want my money back. And the best way to get your money back is to make a game that's like a lot of other successful games, you know? And so it makes total sense that the industry, the large scale AAA industry, is risk averse because there's just so much money going around. And I think in a sense that there's almost too much money in the game industry right now.
Yeah.
At that scale, because I don't think we know enough game design wise to make games at that scale that are like kind of more that are both creatively interesting and reasonable ROI investments. And so I think that like we have a few tricks, we have a few things that we know work. Shooters, you know, work at that scale, and some of the other genres. But besides that, like, it's not that interesting of a place to be right now because you can't actually push too far, right? I mean. Mm-hmm. Whereas indie games right now, you know, when you're talking at the few hundreds to zero size budgets, man, there's just so much creativity and so much different stuff you can do because, like, you know, yes, I'm risking my daughter's ability to go to college, but I'm not risking anything more than that, right? Like, in some sense, she's smart. She'll be able to get a scholarship. So it's great. I mean, it's like, you know, if this fails, I'll just get a job, right? You know, and so it allows me to take really big creative risks, and Spy Party is a big risk. I mean, there's never, you know, it's a totally unique and interesting, bizarre game, and there's games that have aspects of similarity to it, but, like, you know, it's very personal. Like, I'm pushing really hard on certain aspects that another designer would push in different directions, and, like, it's just awesome that I have some prayer, even, of making a sustainable living doing it.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's talk about Spy Party in our, like, last 10 minutes or so we have left. Now, before the cast, you mentioned that the original concept came from a game jam in, I think, 2006?
Even older, yes.
So, in terms of how long you worked on the game, it still has the same concept of this asymmetrical competitive. One player is a spy, one player is a sniper. How has the game design evolved in any sense since the early days of 2006 to where it is right now?
Well, so back in the 2000, you know, back then it was like kind of a kernel of the idea of like, okay, there's a spy at the party and there's a sniper outside looking in. And so that is actually what the game is right now, right? There eventually will be more modes besides just 1v1 and stuff, but I want to get the 1v1 asymmetric mode perfect before I branch out. But just talking just so specifically about the asymmetric 1v1 mode, it's not so much like the high concept, as we say, like that, you know, that core, like, spy at a party, sniper looking in from the outside trying to figure out who the spy is. That has not changed. All the details have changed and evolved and gotten deeper and as I've gotten to know the game. So one example of that, which is maybe not totally obvious from playing the game, but it's a big contrast with the way I was thinking of it. Back then, I figured, oh, what I really want to do is make the most kind of, for lack of a better word, like analog, like very continuous social simulation. So that everything's very subtle. Subtle is the wrong word. Everything's very smooth and that there's no like hard. Okay. So for example, there's three kinds of tells. Here's a more concrete way of talking about it. There's three kinds of tells in the game. Tells are things that give away the spy, right? There's hard tells, which are like bugging the ambassador. It's an animation that only the spy will play. If you see that animation as a sniper, you shoot the spy. You know, you shoot this person who did it, right? Now that animation is somewhat similar to some other animations. So if you're not looking very closely, you might mistake it. And that happens occasionally, but like it's a distinctive enough animation if you're paying close attention. So that's a hard tell. There's soft tells, which are more deductive things. Like there's a code word that gets said if you're in conversation, the spy can contact the double agent and it says the word banana bread, which is a silly thing just from in development. But it basically means the sniper hears that and it means that someone in a conversation did it, right? So nobody at the bookshelves or the windows could have been it. So that allows you to kind of reduce the party down to your suspects. And then there's behavioral tells, which are things like you can put a book away at the wrong bookshelf in order to transfer some microfilm. And the NPCs will never do that. They'll never put the book away at the wrong bookshelf. But no individual thing you did was actually a tell. Like you know, picking up a book, reading it, taking it back to a bookshelf. All the NPCs do all that. They just wouldn't have put it away at the wrong bookshelf, right? And so those three levels, the hard, soft, and behavioral, I used to think I wanted all behavioral tells. And then I realized as I was making the game and people were playing it, that actually the hard tells are very important to the game. Like, it's kind of like, I don't know if you've ever read any of the kind of stuff that about Super Mario Brothers difficulty ramps and stuff, how it goes up and then comes down and then you relax and then goes up and comes down. And the game is a very tense game to play. And it's like chewing nails, sort of, is what Jonathan Blow called it. But like, so one of the very few places in the game where you actually get a little bit of relief during your time as a spy is when you get away with a hard tell. Like, if you're not dead after you bug the ambassador in a couple seconds, like, you know, you got away with it because the hard tell is gone. And so I used to think it was the goal was to get rid of that and to make everything this soupy, soft mass of behavioral tells. But actually, I realized, no, having some hard tells, having some real crisp moments in the game is super important. And so another example is I used to think that the game would be kind of click to move, kind of like The Sims is, rather than direct control on the spy side. But actually, direct control, like, is much more... it's much more closer to like the feel you mm-hmm. want, which is this like direct puppeteering of the spy. And so it feels a lot more intimate as a spy, that the fact that you're in direct control. And in fact, that little bit of micro, you know, StarCraft games like that have this separation between micro and macro, right? It's macro being the strategy, mm-hmm. micro being the kind of click speed and stuff like that, you know, mm-hmm. how fast you are with the UI. Spy Party has micro too. It's not anywhere near as emphasized as it is in StarCraft. But, you know, the ability to move like the NPCs, the ability, like when you collide with another NPC, the ability to have to play that off as the same way the NPC would, the ability to perform the missions like on time at the right, you know, the right intervals and with the right, you know, kind of physical skill. Those are all micro aspects of Spy Party, and those actually make the game deeper. I'd never thought that I would make this game have any micro, because it's about human behavior. But actually, micro is super important to how the game feels and how, the competitive level, like, it just adds this additional thing. Macro in Spy Party will beat micro. You know, if one person's really strong on the micro end of things but doesn't have good macro, like, they're screwed, right? But equal macro, the good micro will win, which is kind of how you want it in these competitive games. You know, if someone's, like, better at strategy and tactics, like, they should win.
Yeah, definitely. Now, with Spy Party, in terms of design, you talked about how you're going to refine the one versus one play and then expand upon the game in the coming years. Could you talk a little bit about any, like, future gameplay or game modes that you're thinking about having as you continue development?
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's all pie-in-the-sky ideas right now, but you can imagine how all these would work. That, like, you know, there's obviously multiple spies at the party, multiple snipers looking in, you know, a mansion with, like, you know, one spy and five snipers, you know, like, in the new art, last month we released the, I think it's still the top post on the blog right now, the new level art. And one of the levels, one of the maps, one of the environments we made was an entire mansion. It's not actually playable yet, but like you can see what it would look like. It's like huge. And like, you know, right now the game takes place in a single room. And so you can imagine like bigger team-based modes, right? So those are the obvious things. Then there's some wackier stuff that starts to get to things like spy sniper teams, right? Like, so you've got a spy and a sniper on your team, and the sniper's trying to get the other guy's spy, the spy's trying to help your sniper, but not give yourself away as you're trying to pinpoint people. I had a crazy idea. You know how Bridge works, the card game Bridge, where basically there's four players who play Bridge, and two players, they sit across from each other on a team. So there's two teams sitting across from each other, and you can kind of signal, you're trying to tell your partner what you've got in your hand without it being obvious, because you're talking across a card table, right? You're not allowed to use secret code words and things like that. And so there's these rules about how that works, but you're kind of trying to you're working together to score. And so I thought this crazy idea, and I don't know if this would work or not, but like basically spy sniper teams where, you know, so one spy, one sniper on each team, where the snipers don't know who your spy is when the game starts, and there's an open chat channel with all four players. So you're kind of trying to...
Nice.
Yes. So you can imagine total insanity that way. And so there's tons of different things like that. I mean, just once I get this core 1v1 mode totally perfect, that's where... Then I can branch out all, you know, tons. I mean, people, you know, like, if you look at more symmetric games that have some similarities, like The Ship or Assassin's Creed Brotherhood multiplayer, or Assassin's Creed multiplayer, I guess now. Those are games of Assassin, which is that college campus game with, we put everybody in the dorm puts their name in a hat, and then like I pick your name, and then you pick Ken's name, and Ken picks my name. So I'm hunting you, but you don't know I'm hunting you, and Ken doesn't know you're hunting him. And that's kind of like the way The Ship and Assassin's Creed works. The problem with those games, and they're cool, but the problem with those games is you all have to watch your back all the time, right? Whereas in Spy Party, I can make the game really deep because you don't have to watch your back. And so, but once I've got this perfect asymmetric thing going, you could imagine the sniper being able to be inside the party and whatnot. Mm-hmm. You know, various game modes like that are worth experimenting. So it's like, the sky's the limit. Like, I know I want the core 1v1 mode to feel like, but like, there's all kinds of craziness besides that we can work on.
All right, I know you have to leave in a few minutes. Do you have time to talk about the art style? If not, we can always come back to it with a...
Yeah, sure. We can spend it. We can spend a couple minutes talking about it.
Okay, so the big news for those who haven't been following Spy Party, I think it was a week or so ago you announced, or you started showing off the new art assets for the game. and looking at it, it looks really incredible. How did you, and I think you said your art designer's name, John?
Yeah, John Simoneau.
How did the two of you come up with the art style for the newly revamped art style for Spyborn?
Yeah, I think he wants no credit for the old art style. yeah, so the old art style looks basically like worse than Sims 1. And the new art style looks, you know, basically like AAA amazing. He's just incredible. He's an incredible artist. So we tried to get the kind of to answer this the question explicitly, like, we tried a lot of different things. But I mean, to go a little bit more into the kind of philosophy of it, you know, there's humans in games are problematic. Like, if you try and go too realistic, you know, you run into what's called the uncanny valley, where everything looks creepy. And you see that nowadays, even in games like, you know, The Last of Us, where they're spending like $1 billion per second of character animation, and it still looks really creepy. And like, I mean, it's getting better and better, but it's still just like weird zombie mask people. And so we knew we didn't want to go super realistic, but at the same time, I didn't want to go super cartoony, you know, not too Pixar-y, because the game is a serious game. I mean, it's got a lighthearted kind of comedy aspect to, you know, all spy fiction is kind of just absurdist, you know, like, you know, James Bond movies are silly in a lot of ways. But like the gameplay itself is like, I want it to be a hardcore esport, you know, Go, poker, StarCraft, Street Fighter kind of thing. And so it's got a little bit of gravitas to it. So I wanted to have something that's serious in a sense. I wanted to kind of skirt that line. I also wanted it to be timeless. I didn't want it to be like Austin Powers, 60s spy guy, you know, or whatever.
Yeah.
And so the kind of the timelessness and then what we ended up calling an illustrative style, like kind of like illustrations from like kind of the turn of the century, like Saturday Evening Post and like, you know, J.C. Leyendecker and those guys had that same, that level of like kind of lightheartedness and abstraction. They weren't really detailed. They weren't trying to be photographs. They were, you know, clearly trying to be illustrations, but not trying to be cartoons either. And it just, we just did a ton of experimentation and it ended up with this kind of what we call this illustrative naturalistic style. And I'm super happy with it, where it's clearly not trying to be a realism. It's not, you know, it's got style. It's it feels really sophisticated and fashionable, but without being, you know, like dated looking, you know, like one person has a mechanic where you check your watch and one of the characters checks a pocket watch and one of the women checks a cell phone. Right. And so like, it's just all of that stuff mixed together at the same time. So I want it to be, timeless in that way. Like, you look at you know, the Pixar movie The Incredibles, which is one of my favorite movies by them. It's not clear when that movie's taking place, right? Like, there's all kinds of different architecture and sci-fi future stuff and older kind of turn of the century mid-century modern kind of like Danish modern type architecture. That's just tons of different stuff, and you're always kind of guessing where and when that movie's taking place. And I kind of wanted that feel too. I didn't want it to feel dated.
Yeah. And I mean, looking at it, it looks incredible. I sort of get this vibe that it sort of reminds me of like Clue almost, like the characters from Clue, the old, you know, mystery, murder.
We definitely like, there's like spy and mystery fiction and tropes. We're totally playing on a lot of these, like this idea of like, there's an ambassador and a briefcase with nuclear plans and all these things. Like, it's great. You know, Spy Party's so weird and different gameplay wise that it's nice to pin down the theme to something people are familiar with. You know, so like, we don't have Super Mario controls for the actual game, but everybody knows that you can poison a drink when there's drinks at a party with spies, right? You know, things like that. Mm-hmm. So like, really trying to like push on those kind of, those tropes, like, you know, seducing someone or, you know, like lighting someone's cigarette and, you know, all these different kinds of things. We're trying to like keep it comfortable in that zone because there's so much different about the game that it's nice to be able to kind of, and also spy fiction is just so absurdly varied, like, you know, all the books and all the movies and everything. And even, you know, theater and things like that. There's just so many spy and mystery, like, you know, like you said, Clue, all these Agatha Christie books, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. There's just all these tropes, all these characters that you kind of expect to be there. And so we want to kind of play to that.
Awesome. Now, I know that you have to get going in a few minutes, so I think we can wrap things up. Chris, it's been a pleasure talking to you. This hour pretty much like flew right by.
Yeah, it went by really fast. Thank you so much.
Yeah, and I'd definitely love to have you back on again later.
Definitely.
So with that said, Chris, as I just said, thanks a lot for coming on. Ken, it was great to have you on as well.
No problem.
Yeah, thanks, Ken.
And we're going to end things here for this week's edition of The Cast. As always, for those of you listening, if you would like to contribute to the site, either as a future podcast or as a writer, you can find a link to our contacts under Submissions Wanted. You'll see the guidelines for writing a piece, as well as the contact link to send me an email. With that said, thanks for tuning in to this week's edition of The Cast. Have a great week, and we will talk to you again next time. Take care, everybody.